If you look carefully at life, you see blur. Shake your hand. Blur is part of life.
Do not mistake sharpness for truth.
Hey, welcome to the Street Shots Photography Podcast. This is Antonio.
And this is Ward.
And this is episode 204 for the end of March 2024. I got the numbers right again.
The numbers right.
I'm so happy
we did make it through the Ides of March this time.
We did make it through the Ides of March. I didn't hear anything about anybody named Caesar getting poked in the back in a big round rotunda area. So I think that was okay. Unless you heard something, but I haven't.
I had a Caesar salad tonight, but I figured we were close enough to the end of the month.
Then that's
fine. It would be okay.
Yeah, that's good. And remember when you visited, you met one of my doormen. His name was Rob.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So he's part of a band. And about a month ago, I went and it was playing down in Bay Ridge. And it was at a place called the Schnitzel House, which was really good food.
I can imagine.
Very good food. Yeah. But they play like once a month. And so this was in February. So their next one was March 15th. And I couldn't go. I had a class. Mm-hmm. But I said, are you guys going to, like, is one of you guys going to dress up like Caesar and have a knife sticking out of your back? And he says, well, I don't know. He goes, one of the guys in the band, he would actually do that. And I was like, well, you should tell him to do it. Like, I wonder how many people would really understand what was going on. Like the guy dressed in a toga with a knife sticking out his back.
Well, those that are cognizant will be, eat it up. I'll get a kick out of it.
Yeah. Although I don't know if in a schnitzel bar, maybe if it was an Italian restaurant, they might notice it and laugh. But I don't know about it. It was a schnitzel place. But we survived March, which didn't seem as long as January to me. I don't know about
it. No, it definitely wasn't as long as January.
January, man. Okay. Well, that's past. It's been a bit busy for me a little bit for like a couple of weeks. Now it's dead. So I have nothing that's going on other than this. And I hope you don't mind me saying it, but I'm going to say that, we were supposed to record last night and and I totally fell asleep before the show and woke up an hour and a half after we were supposed to start and saw all the messages that you left me.
Yeah, but I was, it's all right. A guy needs a nap, man. When he needs a nap.
Yeah. I'm so sorry that I did that. I'm glad you're able to get together with me tonight. And I know I'm a bad boy, I'm doing this like, oh, damn it. Looking at the messages like, oh, are you there? Well, don't tell me you fell asleep.
Get the FDNY after you.
Yeah, well, no, I appreciate the you're looking after me, but you're all the way out there and, I'm sorry to leave you hanging there, but at least you were able to make the best of it, it sounded like, so.
Yeah, it was good. It was fine. I had an hour to sit and surf in peace when people thought I was doing a podcast. And really, I was just had some time to myself and my son's little monstrous, whatever boy cave thing here.
Yeah. Mm. And, are you on borrowed time tonight then?
No.
Or you're good. You're good. Okay. Right.
No, I'm good. And I have the rest of the week off. So it's good.
All right. That's nice. Yeah. It's good for you. So, yeah. So what, a couple of things we got, hopefully we'll be able to fit this all in the time that we want to record, but we got a message from one of our listeners, Mike. He left a message on SpeakPipe. I'll give the address at the end of the show if you want to leave us a message, but his message, let me play it now.
How would I go about starting one of these cooperatives, say in a coffee shop or something like that? Can you give me some tips?
Okay. So what do you think about that? How do we go about starting a cooperative in a coffee shop or something like that?
Yeah,
go ahead. I'll let you start.
Yeah. So my experience was it came from something that my current Beers and Cameras group was an offshoot from an organized one from a camera store. So I don't know if that's, that relevant directly to your question, but I do know that, you know, that our camera store, the camera store in Calgary, does have seminars and things like that, where on Saturday mornings or sometimes on the weekend, they'll have a clinic or they'll have a product day or something where people interested in photography can get together. And I think the best chance of getting, it's about making friends and having people come together that have similar interests. So I think in little events like that, you can make friends and you can start making those connections. And from there, you can have two people, three people get together, work on it, and then find more friends and have it come together and have it be as much, for me, I think the lesson is to have it as much social as it is about the subject matter.
When you say something like similar interests, what do you mean by that? I mean,
well, interest in, well, in this case, we're talking about photography. I mean,
interest in photography, obviously, but like you're talking about similar styles of photography, or
that depends on what you want your little group to be about. Like, what is, you know, what is our unusual collective about? We don't really share anything in terms of style or
absolutely not. No, we're sort of all personal. Over the place.
Well, what is it about us? Why are we even friends? Like, what is it that we like to do? You know?
Yeah. Well, in I think in our case with the unusual collective is we also have a like-minded ideas of approaching photography in some way, some of us. I mean, we actually have a bunch of different people. We have people who want to learn from some other people about stuff. And so that's one thing. But I just got the feeling, and you could tell me if this is true or not, but I always think we have a similar sensibility about photography, all of us, even though if we've got different, you know, focuses in what we shoot and stuff like that. But, and I don't mean like we like certain styles and stuff like that, but I think we have a certain way of approaching and learning stuff and wanting to learn. I mean, does that sound?
Yeah, no, like that's great.
Reasonable.
But every collective is different. Like if you want to, you know, produce something over some period of time or do assignments or do whatever floats your boat in that way, you know, decide what you want to do. But I would say, you know, now you've done these Saturday, was it Saturday morning that you had done?
Yeah, like
the coffee and cameras.
The coffee and cameras, but that sprouted from the two artist talks that I gave at the coffee shop where my pictures were hanging.
Right.
And not that I think that's a prerequisite at all, because I think that could have been something we could have done without having a show there. You know, I mean, if I could have approached the coffee place that, you know, got to know the owner, I know the owner there, and then say, hey, I want to try to set something up where, you know, we can have an artist talk or sort of a gathering of artists and, you know, maybe have refreshments and stuff like that and figure out something with the owner, I would have probably done that. In this case, I already had the venue for that. And then, you know, it came into my mind that it would be kind of a great thing to do with people in the neighborhood to just start it. So, you know, the initial gathering was something that gave me the audience to say, you know, hey, I want to start this thing, you know, and if anybody wants to be involved with it. And I'm not sure that coffee and cameras is a collective as much as it's a,
no,
you know,
but it's also like a camera place club for people to gather.
It's a place for gathering. Yeah. And, you know, I decided to use Facebook as the method for everybody to communicate with each other, just because it's the, pretty much everybody knows how to use it, and I didn't want to exclude anybody. And I did actually talk about using Discord, which I prefer doing because that's what we're using for our collective, and it's not part of the Facebook system, which kind of, you know, feel one way about it.
Yeah,
but I think that's adding to the complications. So with our unusual collective, it's easy because I think we're all savvy about this kind of stuff, and it wasn't a big deal to do that. So I think it depends on the audience. But anyway, like offering a gathering, you know, someone has to be set up the initiative. So Mike, like if you know a coffee shop that you go to all the time or some venue and you know the person there, I mean, even if you're not hanging a show, maybe it's something to do where you call on them and say, hey, I'd like to, is it possible that we could, you know, do something in your place at night? Like maybe I could, you know, call for a gathering of photographers and have, you know, other photographers or other artists or something like that come and talk And you know, I guess the idea with like a coffee shop or something like that, because it could bring customers in and people can know the place and whatnot.
Right.
But, you know, you do have to have the place to come to. I mean,
right.
But it doesn't necessarily, it doesn't even have to be like you're hosting something, but I think that's a good, it's kind of a good way to sort of introduce yourself and like then bring out the ideas that you might have. And if you want to start with, you know, gatherings, I don't know how long it took us to create our collective. I mean, we just sort of did it and then started, right?
Yeah, I was a latecomer though.
Yeah, you were part of the second or third wave to come in, I think.
Yeah.
But anyway, having that kind of place where you can gather and bring people in and meet them in person or something like that, or like, even though like us in the usual collective, I don't think most of us haven't met in person when we started.
Nope.
No. I might have met Matt.
No, it's a big deal when we do, actually.
Yeah, you know, it is. Yeah. It's just because we're so far away from each other, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, that's also part of it. It doesn't necessarily have to be something where you meet somebody in person, right?
No.
Part of what I was doing what I also want to do with the coffee and cameras places, too, is just have this group that can be solid together. We don't always have to meet in person, right? Mm-hmm. The idea is that we can communicate our ideas and stuff like that through all these different systems that we have. And, you know, for us in our unusual collective, it's like this nice little backdoor personal place that is away from all the noise and stuff and the ads and, you know, and I'm grateful that we have this nice little place. And so I don't necessarily think it's something that you have to necessarily meet in person for all the time, because that can bust into people's schedules. So like if you're able to do a collective and start it online, you know, it's great if you can meet people in person, but like to offer this like an online space where you can have these kind of discussions away from prying eyes, you know, I think that's also an option. So I'm not sure if this is perfectly answering your question about it, like, you know, in a coffee shop or something like that, but
yeah,
you know, it's, you know, in some of our cases, I think it was sort of an organic growth, right?
Also, too, I think I would say with a collective and like with ours, it ebbs and flows. And
I'm talking about like our
you
our
have to be patient. Yeah,
yeah.
Your participation. You have to kind of let things work organically, like you were just saying there. Mm. And that there will be periods where there may not be much activity at all. And then there'll be springtime or summertime when, oh, we're going to go out and do some photo walks or do something.
Right.
Specific to your right. season or yeah. some event that's going on in your city or your town.
Yeah.
It is interesting. You get together, find an excuse to shoot stuff together.
Yeah.
I think is a great way if you are physically close.
Yeah. That is helpful. And I think part of the collective idea is also trying to do things together, you know, like mm-hmm. whether it's working on a website together, or, you know, a zine or a book or something like that, which we haven't done yet as our collective. One of the things we wanted to do is make a book. We still have that sort of, we have that channel tucked away yeah. in Discord. It's like, make a book. And maybe we'll get around to that or something like that. But I think for all of us, we know that we have this little spot that we can go to anytime. Mm-hmm. And, you know, yeah, being patient is part of it. You know, not everybody is on the same schedule and stuff like that. So I like it. I like it a lot, or like having that a lot, because it's just this little comfort space that I know I can talk about photography or whatever. You know, it's mm-hmm. I think for our collective, it's not just about photography, right? Because we're all now friends. And so we have this little space where we can sort of talk about stuff on to each other on our own with not having the outside come in and criticize. I also think part of this has to do with we also have some unwritten rules in our collective, I've noticed. Like, we don't talk politics.
No.
And I'm grateful for that, because, you know, that is become the decisive, like, we're the divisive thing now in our world. Mm-hmm. And I'm all against, like, you know, I'm grateful that we don't do that, because we're all connecting on the levels that we are, that's important to us, right? And so,
yeah, there are other places for that, not here.
There are other places for that. And you know what? What's really interesting about this is that we're all from different locations and stuff like that. And we've learned to become friends without that noise in the mm-hmm. system. And almost at this point, it doesn't even matter that it's not part of our, I don't know. It's just not part of our makeup. And I'm really, really happy about that. And I know that some of the rest of the guys are listening to this episode and they're going to say, you know, they think we're probably all happy about that. But it was an unwritten thing. We just don't do that. And maybe it wasn't an unwritten thing. It's just like, this is how we might act as if we were in person, you know,
yeah,
or something. I don't know. But
no, I think you're spot on.
Yeah. So, you know, we when we started the collective, we did have some rules, you know, or guidelines or something like that, you know, to try to keep things sort of in an order or something like that. And generally, like, there would need to be someone or a couple of people who can just sort of keep the ball rolling a little bit, because like you were saying, we all sort of fade away after a while. And it's like, it's nice to have someone who can just poke the fire a little bit, you know,
mm-hmm.
and get that going. So anyway, I'm hoping that's kind of in the direction of an answer, you know, or, you know, guidance or something like that. But I do think that starting off with some initial gathering, whether it's online or, you know, pulling people in. So someone does have to take an initiative and do it. I think actually in our group, I think it was Mac who started it. I think it was Mac.
Well, he set up the Discord server.
No, he set up the Discord, but I think it was his idea to start a collective. Mm. Now, I could be wrong, but I know it wasn't me who came up with the idea, you know? And so, but I do think it was him. That's why I thought we were doing it on the Shutter Time show when we were doing our Black Couch session, and somehow either after that,
Genesis of it was the Black Couch session.
Yeah, it was, because we were all talking about it. So yeah, it did gel from a podcast that we were doing. But I think Mac came up with that, and I know he came up with the Unusual Collective name. So I can put a lot of credit for him. Thank you, Mac, because that was one of the best ideas to cross in front of me for a long time. You know, and again, I'm always grateful for it. It's a great place to share. You know, that's the other thing. Sorry, I'm going on about this maybe longer, but I think part of the important thing is to build trust. That takes some time. And because in the collective that we're doing here, I trust that if I throw pictures in there or whatever I'm going to say, A, it's going to stay in there, right? That it's not getting leaked out into the world or nobody's sharing the stuff. And that I will, in a sense, trust the opinions and words that are spoken to me. Like, you know, I'm not dismissive of it. So that, you know, I think that's almost more important than to where you gather, is that finding a core group of people who are trustworthy to each other. And so how to build that, that's going to take time. So it's really not like you put up a sign on a, you know, a lamppost and say, starting a photo collective next Tuesday, come and meet, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if that necessarily is going to work, but I think it's going to be trying to create relationships with people sort of on the outside a little bit and then bring them in, you know, and then talk about that. So, because, you know, if you just make an open call, you might end up with people who are not quite understanding what this is about or don't take it in the way that you want to take it. And that can bring to like rough edges and hard breaks and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that might not be the best way to start. So anyway, that's all I got to say on that.
All so right. Thanks. Thank you, Mike, for using SpeakPipe.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Cool. It was great to hear your voice. Yeah. So I hope you don't mind we put your voice on air. On air. Are we on air? We're not on air. No.
Well, it's a colloquial term.
Yeah, I know.
Okay. Being on the air.
So, all right. So that's that. I wanted to also just acknowledge that today that we're recording on the 27th of March, that it's Edward Steichen's birthday. And I don't know if we ever did a show about him. So
I don't think so.
Could we sort of pencil that in at some point? Because
sure.
Is the guy's career is, I don't want to spend too much time talking about it, but the guy's career spanned a whole lot from, you know, pictorialism to World War II, right? I mean, he's in charge of photography section in World War II. So I've got a book, him called Steichen at War, and the pictures are quite amazing. And I think he was head of a photography group. And so, I can't remember the name of some of the photography that they did. But anyway, you know, his pictorialism, the photographs of, oh man, I'm spacing out on the names of the shots now, but the Flatiron Building image.
Yeah.
That's at that used to be at the Metropolitan Museum. Was it there? It was there. And What else? The picture of that. What's that woman with the, she's covered in the veil. Do you remember who that is? It's someone famous. Anyway, there's that picture. And then it's just his range of stuff. So I saw someone posted today that it was his birthday, and I checked it, March 27th, 1879. And he died 2 days before his birthday, March 25th, 1973. But that's a long, well-lived life as a photographer.
Up at Lake George, right? That's where that was his haven. That's where he always went to recharge. Yeah.
So anyway, I wanted to acknowledge his birthday. And like I said, pencil him in, because I would love to do a deep dive on his work as much as we can do in a show. But I definitely like to spend time. So that also brings up, I wanted to acknowledge that this past Sunday, so this is the 25th, we're recording on Wednesday. So 3 days ago, a friend of mine passed away, a really good photographer. His name is Mel DiGiacomo. And I wanted to spend a little time talking about him to acknowledge him and his being and his influence and just stuff. And so this is probably gonna be the first time that many of you or all of you have, you know, heard of him. He was sort of not in the fame department, but for us photographers in New York, he was. He was known as Mel. And yeah, he passed away on Sunday at the age of 85. And I first met Mel at the photo agency I worked at called the Image Bank. And I met him in the mid-80s, late-80s. That's when I started working in the late-80s. And he was the kind of photographer that I wanted to be. Think of a quintessential kind of, I don't know, just like he's a really laid-back, bespectacled, kind of, you know, potty-mouthed, wise-ass, you know, kind of person with an attitude who's very, very confident in himself. Not like, you know, over the top, but I mean, but like he knew who he was. He did a lot of photography for Newsweek, and mostly he shot a lot of covers for Newsweek. And he also was a photographer who photographed the U.S. Open a lot. He is close friends with a lot of the tennis stars. We have many pictures of him with Maria Navratilova. Yeah. They were really close friends. And he would photograph sports, rugby, tennis, basketball. He would do these photojournalist kind of things. He also would do wedding photography, and he did it in a photojournalistic style. And when I got married to my first wife, I met her at the Image Bank as well, and she knew Mel, and we had decided to hire him as our wedding photographer. And to the maybe not happiness of some of the family members, because it was very happy for me and my ex-wife, we were incredibly happy about it because we were getting Mel to do his style, which was, and I'll post some of my pictures of our wedding in the show notes so you can see it. But it was very documentary, black and white, wide angle, flash on camera or off camera actually, but in the face. And, you know, family members like, well, where are the pictures? Where are the wedding pictures? Like, well, these are it. This is what you're getting. I'm going to put Mel's voice in right now so you can just hear a little bit of what he's saying.
There's nothing like being a photographer. There's all kinds of pain, all kinds of suffering, and all kinds of wonderful joy. So take the good with the bad. And remember what, Samuel Beckett said, ever try, ever fail, try again, fail better. So keep doing it. You're going to fail. There's no question about it. But failures are the portals to success. You learn from them. Don't get discouraged by them. We all make mistakes. So learn from your mistakes and keep making them. And you'll get better and better and better and better. So you'll make fewer and fewer and fewer mistakes. I got to answer that phone. Excuse me.
Okay. So I want to just throw his voice in so you can hear what he sounds like. I'm going to put a link to his videos that he was recorded at B&H at the event space. He would do a lot of seminars there. But anyway, Mel would walk in with, like, I don't know if he had a photo vest, but I don't think he was a photo vest guy. He was a really cool guy, but he always had the Leica around his neck. And I mean, he wasn't, you know, wearing it as jewelry. That camera was beat to hell.
It was a tool. Yeah.
Yeah. And in fact, for him, this stuff was only tools, right? He was never really wrapped up in the equipment other than, like, when he finally got into digital, he was really understanding about, like, how he can push the limits of it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I would look at him and I was like, he's the kind of photographer I want to be. Like, to me, he was like the photographer, right? He walked in, he was confident. He would bring in prints. You know, he would always bring in prints. By the way, he was like, he would go crazy in his darkroom and he would print. And actually, I just showed you when we're offline from our wedding pictures. Instead of giving us an album, he gave us a whole bunch of 8x10 black and whites in an Ilford paper box.
That is classic. I think that's
what is it? An Ilford multi-grade 3 paper, rapid paper box. And I still have the box. And that's where I still store the prints, which I'm sure he would appreciate.
Yeah.
And, you know, we would all stop our work and we go look at the prints that Mel would bring in. And, you know, they had nothing to do with stock photography most of the time. It was just, you know, the stuff that he was shooting, you know, and it was just, he was one of these people who, like, you could kind of hang on every word that he said. And he was really good at teaching people and being very patient. He had a mouth on him, though. That was like, and I just won't repeat the things that he called me up until the last time I saw him, which I did see him at B&H, I don't know, a handful of years ago when he did a talk. And Jay Mazel was there as well. But he called me by this nickname, which I won't say. But he used to think, even though I'm partially Cuban, he would always think that I was Puerto Rican. And he was just busting my chops.
Yeah.
And he did it in such a way that, like, you know, I would say, fine. I just didn't care anymore. Because it was Mel. You couldn't tell him to do things.
Yeah.
And actually, one of the times he came and showed prints, he brought in a bunch that he shot with a hole gut. So he was very into testing and playing around with new cameras and just new styles of stuff. And he had a couple of pictures in this pile that he brought in. One was of a bride, which had a really crazy light leak on it. And it was really, she almost looked like a ghost. And I fell in love with that picture. And then he flipped through more and he found another picture of some discarded chairs on a sidewalk. And I was like, I need those two prints. And I bought them. And I totally forgot about them because I don't have them on my wall now. So I've got other prints. And so the last time I had them up was in my old apartment, but we moved here in 2008. So it's been a while since I've seen those prints. And I kind of totally forgot about them until when I heard that he passed away on Sunday. I started reminiscing a bit and I was like, oh, wait, I've got those prints someplace. And then I recognized, like, wait, the picture of the chairs. I'll put that picture in the show notes to show you. And I was like, wait a minute. Is that where I've been getting my idea for photographing discarded chairs?
Chairs, near photo DNA, man. It's mainlining that one.
Well, perhaps because this picture has been up in our apartment. It was up for a long time. So I don't know how long, but like it was one of our, we had these two walls in our living room that had both of his images up. It had this bride, which is kind of weird because people are like, is that your wedding picture? And like, no, it's not. It's just a picture of a bride. It was really nice.
Mel's picture.
Yeah. But then this picture of the chairs was always there in our living room. And I must've been looking at it all the time. And so I think that those images, or at least certainly the chair images, has affected me. And to this day, I still photograph chairs. And I was always wondering, like, where did this come from? Like, why did I want to start shooting chairs? And this photograph is beautiful. I haven't shown it to you, right? And did I send it to you?
Did not. Well, the chairs.
No,
one,
the chairs one you didn't see yet, right? No.
No, I have. You posted.
Oh, you did. I did post it for you. Okay, yeah, so you know what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah.
It's a great shot. And so it's a, I don't know, it's a 12 or 14 inch square, so it's pretty decent sized, matted and stuff like that. So anyway, I'm really happy about that, and I'm really sad I haven't seen him in a long time. And every now and then he would pop up on my Facebook feed in the past couple of years, as I was talking, when I talked about Elizabeth dying, he would pop up and give me some words of comfort. He always wrote in caps. I was wondering if he was having a hard time seeing.
Yeah.
So he was just typing in caps to see. I part of me wanted to say, Mel, are you yelling at me? And like, no, he doesn't care. And he doesn't know what's going on about, like, you know, caps being all that. And he wouldn't give a crap anyway. But I did want to acknowledge him. And if you haven't heard of him, probably haven't, you know, see if you can take a deep dive into some of his work somewhere along the line, like do a search for him. Again, I'll put a link to the B&H videos, and they're worth listening to. His photography prowess and the way he approached photography is kind of the way that I've always wanted to do it. And I'm sorry that I didn't really always follow up with him and stuff like that. And that's just a regret that I got to live with. But he did have an influence on me, and I wanted to acknowledge his being and presence and share these memories with everybody so that now he can live on a little bit longer in other people. So please look at his work. Please watch the videos. Street photographer, the guy is fantastic. Oh my gosh. His stuff that he shot, he lives in Jersey. So he would photograph a lot of people looking at the New York skyline, or like kids jumping off of, you know, piers into the Hudson River or stuff like that. He just had a really good eye and, you know, and sort of an unsung hero of photography, I think. So I'll put him in that department. But he's going to be missed. And but you're not going to find that kind of photographer around that much anymore. It was just that old school kind of really, like, he lived photography, right? And I think he would roll his eyes a lot about what's going on now with it. So anyway, Mel, you know. I will not say my nickname that he gave me, but Mel, take care, and I'll you know, hopefully you and Elizabeth are hanging out with each other. Elizabeth liked him too, so
cool. It was
a good pairing. So anyway, thanks for the time to let me say this.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, and I'll you sent that video along, so I'll definitely watch that here in the next day or so.
Yeah, cool. On to the topic is, or what we came up with tonight.
I'm having trouble focusing.
I can't focus on anything.
what is it that we're going to be talking about?
Yeah, well, you know, the idea of talking about blurriness in photographs, in photography.
We're talking about intentional blurriness?
Let's talk about intentional blurs. Let's not talk about mistakes. Although those could be sometimes happy mistakes.
They can be happy mistakes, and take credit for your mistakes if they work.
Yes. Yeah. I do tell my students, like, if you notice something that's a happy accident, take credit for it. If it's garbage, throw it out and start over again. Don't try to, you know, fix it. But this idea of having intentional blur in photographs. And when I thought about it, I realized it was something that I love seeing in pictures and I have yet to really do for myself.
Mm.
And as I started to do some searches and stuff, as we're researching, you know, imagery for this topic and how blur comes up as motion blur and intentional out of focusness. I mean, it's, you know, I actually think blur and out of focus are two different things, but they sort of fit the same, whatever that category would be. But, you know, intentional blur being like motion.
Something that's not sharp. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, so the one of the shots that popped up was the Ernst Haas image of the bullfight, which is I think both intentional blur and maybe a little bit out of focus. And I mean, I'll put it in the show notes, but, and if you want to search for it, you can. It is this in sort of, you know, centered shot of a bullfighter with a red or orange or pink. It's hard to see depending on the color. What is it called that they're
cape.
Carrying?
I'll call it a cape.
Cape or something like that. And the bull sort of merged with it, and they're all sort of blurred together in the center of this picture. And so you can kind of see feet and motion, and you could feel the camera was probably moving as well. That's a beautiful shot. I mean, not a big fan of bullfighting.
Like pointillist impressionist painting.
Yes. Yeah. It is certainly that. And then, you know, going a little further into it and thinking about, like, well, you know, was it William Klein? Was he from New York? He was from New York, huh?
I don't remember.
I know that some of his pictures.
I know he was American.
A lot in New York, yeah. But, you know, in his pictures, different kind of blur where there's intentionally out of focus people in the foreground, or the picture itself is out of focus, or maybe it's a long exposure and there's motion blur and out of focus. Like, it almost doesn't matter that maybe the main subject is not in focus. And anyway, we'll talk about a couple of other photographers in a minute, but I thought it was a really interesting thing to sort of dive into. And every now and then, like, I'll come across a photograph somewhere in a stream or something like that has this intentional out of focusness, maybe more that than the blur. Cause the blur is something that we see a lot, like motion blur when you're panning the shot or something like that. Right. That's pretty typical. I still like that kind of photography, but I look at that stuff and I just think it's interesting that it's something I really like and I don't do it myself.
Why do you like it? I mean, let's break it down a little bit.
Okay. So, you know, thinking about blur in general and how it has so there's a very kind of dreamlike quality to the imagery, right?
Sure.
It seems that those kind of images seem to tap more into an emotional response.
It's not just sharp description of something. It's an impression. Yeah,
definitely. It's an impression. Yeah. Whether it's blurry, like the Ernst Haas shot is from the motion, or it's an out of focus picture, there's some ambiguity in it. Yeah. And it kind of mimics, I was thinking about this, it kind of mimics memory, right? Because to me, thinking about, like, when I'm trying to remember my dreams, it's I've been trying to write a journal in the morning, and it's not a dream journal, but like it's morning pages journal. And I really try to start to write my dreams because it gets me starting to write, and I can't remember it. And it's like a fog. And as I was looking at these kind of pictures, they kind of remind me of that. There's a foggy memory thing that's going on, which feels more like real life.
Okay.
Like a real life experience than sometimes a photograph does, a regular photograph, like where the motion is stopped. Because I think we live in a world, most of us, with our eyes, and the world does not stop, right?
No.
And where photography is showing stopped motion and very clear things. I don't think that's how we experience life. And so when I see a picture like this, you know, that's out of focus or blur motion, that feels more like how I see the world in some way.
Right.
Which is interesting, because if I see the world in that way, why haven't I tried to record it that way? But yeah, so I think it mimics the selective focus of our vision, where, you know, our peripheral vision is kind of really not sharp, and our point that we're looking at is, so there's this, it's sort of the opposite, like where the edges are not in focus, but the center is. So it kind of mimics that. So, but all that means that it has a feeling of something more internal and I don't know, visceral or something like that. I mean, I'm not sure I'm being clear of that. So I don't know if that resonates with you or something like that.
But no, it doesn't. It was just the way you were talking about the, you know, there's the passage of time thing, which you and I both love, you know, talk about time travel or whatever, you can catch it.
Right.
I know with our friend Shane and his glass plate pictures, exposure time is 10 seconds, right? 9 seconds, right. 10 seconds. The passage of time is recorded on that plate, you know. Couldn't quite hold his head in exact, so there's a little bit of blur there. There's a little bit of sideways movement that, you know, he's alive. And I was just thinking when you were talking just now about, and I was thinking about my pictures in Mexico. There was a common thread of blurred human subjects that went in through the frame, or however you want to put it, the little bit of blur that was in the image reflected, and I was thinking about it at the time, it reflected life, the people in the place, in that particular town. Because we know when we were making the decision to go with the subject, And you were saying that how it was something you don't do and something I think about every now and then, but I have very few pictures that depict that. I think the Mexico project was the one where it's there the most. Mm-hmm. But I only have three or four in the last 10 years of work where I was like, okay, this is something going on here. And there really is, like you're saying about the emotional part of it, there's something big going on. It definitely has a, there's more of an explosion of feeling, I think, in the blurry pictures than there are in the ones that are sharp, where it's not just describing what it is I'm shooting, but there's a feeling about it. Certainly open to interpretation, but there's definitely like a, oh, wow thing that happens.
Yeah. You're thinking of it that way. It seems to be a hard, or for me, a difficult thing to do on like a natural way for me to photograph, right? I actually have to stop and think about the most recent pictures that I've done with blur. And I think they might be the only ones that I did intentionally with blur or out of focusness was, it was in Greenwood Cemetery. And I was like, you know what? I want to photograph these, the statues and photograph mm-hmm. those a zillion times. I'm like, how am I going to do this differently? How can I see this stuff differently? And my camera was set to black and white. So it's really helpful to be shooting with the, you know, a mirrorless camera. With the electronic viewfinder, because it's really, really helpful. It's a pre-visualization tool. You know, mm-hmm. that's what I love about it. And I was like, what happens if I just throw the foreground out of focus? And so the foreground has got the angel or statue or whatever it is, and I'm focusing on the trees in the background. And there's one mm-hmm. picture that came out I really like because it's, you can tell the shape. It's almost like a silhouette of a of an angel, and it looks a little kind of ominous or something like that. And as we were, again, we were talking about this subject, and I was like, I wonder if I had any pictures. And I was like, oh, that's the only one I remember doing was that picture. And I did it. I had to do it intentionally. I had to stop and do it, and pay attention and say, okay, throw this out of focus. Because my natural tendency is to focus on the thing that I'm taking a picture of. And mm-hmm. why would I do it out of focus? Like, that's like my, that's, you know, that's sort of the logical part. That's the part, the voice that's saying, do things the way you've done them before. Focus the lens, take the picture, make sure the camera's steady, and then, you know, see if you've got a picture. Whereas this other part is like, wait, stop, do something that's not what your usual thing is and see what happens. I mean, that's like with any kind of experiment in photography, like try this thing. And part of it is that if you don't do it enough, you don't do it often enough, it becomes a, you know, oh, it's a one-off. And they're like, well, that's really interesting. That's cool. You know, but could I do more like that? I don't know. Because the muscle memory is to go back and focus the camera or hold it steady so there's no motion blur or something like that. But yeah, you know, you're mentioning the images that Shane's doing, and that was probably the first thing that attracted me to his work. Even though he has the subject hold steady as much as possible, there is that little bit of, like, you know that there's time captured in the picture.
The person's breathing, you know.
The person is breathing, yeah. And this is different from out of focus. This is just capturing time, but there's a life energy in that kind of work. There's a life energy in the, you know, person who's blurred in the foreground while, you know, because you can imagine that you're looking at the people behind this person and someone walks between you and the other person and they're just a blur because they just, you don't have time to focus on them. They just walk by. Mm-hmm. And the photographs to capture that. The one picture that you had showed me that you took in the city, which, can we put that in the show notes too?
Sure.
Yeah. So of that little girl who's...
It's a little boy.
Little boy? Oh, okay. Yeah. Sorry.
He's dressed in a Spider-Man uniform or Spider-Man pajamas. You can't really see that.
But, you know, I was looking at the shot and I was like, well, you know what? It did feel like your picture, actually. Even the, like, you have some stuff like that don't you have stuff like that in the Stampede? Some kind of pictures because you're in crowds and stuff?
Yeah. I don't usually have the camera pointed down. I was a kid, so I had the camera pointed down. Mm-hmm. But
actually, it looked like the camera's at the same height as the kid, but, you know.
Yeah. Well, but the street is going in the car. There's a car in the
At it now.
In the background.
Yeah, but I was like, it's not a typical photograph.
Yeah, for you, though. Yeah, true enough. No, it isn't, and it was a. I wanted something, and it was a very quick reaction, and I knew that he would be out of focus, and I had some success with some street pictures before of two adults kind of fawning over a child on Broadway.
Oh right,
they were listening to the child and the kid was looking up as back to the camera and talking to, I think, a courier, to a UPS driver about something. And the intent and the interest in the child was really palpable, I think, in that image. Really interested in what this little one was having to say. And like, it's like putting a spotlight on a kid who's like, finally, I got some adults. I can tell them they're interested in what I have to say, you know?
Was that shot similar way? Was there a similarity in the
way it was? No, this was a little bit different. It was darker because the kid was kind of being pulled along. And
well, what I mean is picture. Like in this one, you said you knew that the kid would be out of focus. In that other picture that you're describing, was there an issue?
No, there
of blurry?
Wasn't. No, it was just okay. Because I had a successful picture of a kid. And so I wanted something that was like, because I don't want to take pictures of children that are identifiable.
Right.
Like it's just, it's not right. It's not, you know, you don't have, I'm a street photographer and it's something you don't have permission from parents or anything like that. So I don't want them to be identifiable.
Gotcha.
So this young boy was kind of being pulled across from the street onto the sidewalk as I was walking. And was in fairly close proximity to me. So I thought, you know, he'd be out of focus or something. I don't know what exactly it would look like, but I did the grab shot and turned out that the stuff behind him was tack sharp. And it's funny too, because in the gaps behind him, there was a car in the pavement, and on the other side, kind of in the crook of his elbow, do I want to say, or something.
Yeah.
There was a broom.
Right above his arm. Yeah, I could see
Right above his arm. Like, just kind of a surreal thing of what, I mean, the meaning could mean anything to you, but the way I printed it, I wanted it dark because it was kind of a dark mood and the kid was not.
But you saw something happy in the picture that, sorry, I want to go back to the blurriness of it. I mean, you had anticipated that would not be in focus.
Right.
Just because of your camera and your settings, and you went with the picture anyway. So what was it about this that you pulled out?
No, it was the dark feeling of the kid was being pulled along and wasn't happy.
Yeah. So it wouldn't have had the same thing if the kid was in focus, though. Probably not. Probably wouldn't have had that same.
Well, no, there's definitely more. I mean, I can't say because I don't know. I don't even know if I, you know, like you said, I probably might not have used it if the little one was in focus.
Yeah. But forgetting skipping your,
No, I don't mean the moral part, but I'm just saying, the rule, but I don't think it would have had the emotional impact that it does because there isn't details in his face. It's
right.
An impression of a.
So you chose to keep it dark. It's out of the child is out of focus and is blurry because of the movement. So you got a little motion in there. Yep. It's almost like it really looks like something that you might have shot with a film camera. I mean, that's kind of part of what these things do for me, especially now with digital photography, because this was kind of the norm more often than not with when we were shooting film cameras with manual focus lenses, right? Unless you knew how to focus very fast, and you know, you might have been shooting
or your zone focusing, whatever.
Yeah, still, but you know, things would happen really fast. I was never a fast focuser, so you know, I would end up with pictures. I know I'd end up with pictures that were out of focus, but they were not intentionally out of focus. It was just because I didn't do it. But when I see a shot like this that you're showing me here, this kid, it's got that feeling of, for me, reminds me of the early days of photography for me, like. In a good way, like this is where you hit and miss. And this is like, you know, looking at some of the William Klein pictures, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
when you showed me pictures, William Klein pictures, I'm thinking, I don't have any pictures like that. And I'm like,
wait a minute.
Oh, no, maybe I do have one.
Yeah.
And so, it's in your town. So
and so that's reminiscent more of that. And it's not because, I mean, I don't want to say that blurry pictures are reminiscent of film in general, but for me, like, especially this shot of yours definitely taps into that. But it's interesting because you knew that the picture was going to be out of focus and you still took it.
No, because the way I shoot with that camera, and you saw me working with it.
Yeah.
I'm priming the focus all the time and pointing it, you know, at the subject, and I had just primed it, and I was holding down the shutter release.
Yeah.
And when he came by, I swung the camera around a little bit and then tripped the shutter.
Yeah.
Just hoping that he was going to be in the frame. This was way, like, just below chest level, where the Fuji strap ends.
Yeah, yeah.
On so my chest there.
What do you think about, well, actually, so, well, talking about Klein and stuff, and I can't read his mind or what was going through it, but, you know, he's going for this kind of look, and maybe with the picture that you're doing, going against sort of a norm of, you know, the picture has to be sharp. We have to see the subject. And both you guys in this sense, you know, are like saying, well, no, you don't have to. And so what do you, I don't know, what do you say about that?
Well, most of my pictures, that's a very rare exception that I do that. Most yeah. of the time I want to have, and I want to honor my subjects by having sharp pictures of them and have the background be out of focus. What I like about background, we'll just skip back a little bit off the rails a little bit. One of the reasons why I like the background to be out of focus is in black and white, very often the background details have really great tones, like a silvery, mm-hmm. you know, whatever you want to call it, a gossamer or something hanging behind the person that you're photographing. I love that. I love those open areas of tone and so on. But that picture of that kid on Old Fulton Street there, that was a spur of the moment thing. I saw this situation developing and I just, you know, kind of reacted. So, but yeah, I don't think of, and in that situation, I didn't really know at all what the print was going to look like, what the image was going to look like. Mm. It was just sort of a hope that there was some meat in there that I could extract out of it. And that one turned out to be pretty good, but it's not intentional. Like most of the time, like I'm not going there.
So, you know, let's talk about a little bit of some intentional work that I came across, which was a couple of people who just jumped off the bat. First of all, is the Alexei, how do you pronounce his last name?
Titarenko
with his City of Shadows work. I mean, a lot of that is camera lockdown and the subjects, the people in the streets or something like that, turning into blurs that are almost clouds, like they're ghosts or something like that. So that's a very,
or like it's a some kind of grimy fog.
Yeah, so grimy fog is the way, because usually when you see the pictures that are where there's a long exposure with people, you can kind of tell that they're people, you know, there's mm-hmm. some legs and stuff like that. This is very hard to tell they're people. Every now and then you might see a hand or something. It's almost like smoke. That's mm-hmm. the best way I can think of this. The smoke monster from what was it? What was that show?
Smoke Monster.
Yeah, the show that everybody hated the way it ended. Darn it, I can't remember it now.
Firefly.
Lost.
Oh, Lost.
Yeah, it's like the smoke monster. But I really haven't dived into his work. I remember seeing one-off pictures every now and then of his stuff.
Yeah.
But I wasn't thinking of it in terms of motion blur, it was just something else. But when you start seeing all these pictures together that like other photographers are doing intentionally, another photographer that popped in, which I was looking for this before, and I don't know if this is the right photographer, but it's seen, actually, I don't think this is the guy. Actually, now that I was thinking about it, there was a photographer who, and I think it's a Japanese photographer, but I don't remember his name, who was photographing with a 4x5 camera and setting the focus to beyond infinity. Like, cause you know that some cameras the lenses can go beyond infinity. And why do they go beyond infinity sometimes? Do we know that? I know why, but I don't want to know if you want. I was like testing you. I know on my Nikon lenses why it does. So I'm not sure about 4x5. I think 4x5 is it. But do you know why? To compensate for heating and the expansion.
Okay.
So anyway, I always looked at my lens like, why does it go beyond infinity? And so I'm going to have to look up this other photographer, because now I'm remembering what the technique was a little bit. But I did a search for Beyond Infinity, and I came up with this other photographer, Bill Armstrong, who's also photographing everything with the lens set to infinity. And so intentionally, things that are close to the camera are going to be out of focus, which obviously it turns it into a more of an abstract kind of expression.
And the closer the subjects are, the more abstract,
you know,
they become.
But, you know, you can see the shapes. And I'm even thinking about, like, some of the stuff that we, you know, in the Trent Park books and stuff like that. I mean, I think he's playing with the blur and the focus as well. But those kind of intentional things, I think the Beyond Infinity is really interesting to like setting the camera up to Beyond Infinity, because you're automatically not going to have anything in focus, whether it's even something in the background, because once you focus past infinity, anything that's far away is still going to be unsharp, you know? And so, and I don't know if he's photographing with this other photographer I was thinking about. I don't know if he's photographing with the lens wide open or not, but anyway, it's these, I'll put the links in the show notes. And was another
Bill Armstrong's image and Bill Armstrong's image are very primary colors, bright.
Right. They're boiled down to like to, you know, think about his pictures next to Trent Park's pictures, like the totally opposite. But I think they would work. It's funny. I'm like thinking about, I could see them working together in some way, like them sort of complementing each other in a way. And the obvious way is the color in black and white. But I think in terms of some of the shapes and stuff they're covering. But yeah, there's, and then actually circling back to, you know, Edward Steichen and the Pictorialists, right? You know, I was just writing about in my photo journal the photograph that Steichen took of the Brooklyn Bridge. I think it's at night. And it's this sort of abstract, like if you don't know what the Brooklyn Bridge, I mean, this looks like the Brooklyn Bridge, but it's so, there's a blurriness to it. I don't know how he did this, so I can't say it was intentionally out of focus or it's a long exposure, but it's not a very, you know, it's a more abstract pictorialist, you know, image of the Brooklyn Bridge. It's a very iconic image of the Brooklyn Bridge, but I would throw that image in, or maybe others that pictorialists do, because they were looking to sort of move away from the way photography was being presented at the time, which is everything very factual and clean. Right. They're trying to mimic another art source. But that image of the Brooklyn Bridge to me, you know, says, you know, I would definitely put it in this intentional blurry out of focusness. Like he knew what he was doing. It wasn't a mistake. This was an intentional thing to create it's abstract, but we know what the subject is, you know, just like the photographs from this photographer, Bill Armstrong, you know, that there's human shapes in it. So it's an abstract human shape. But so anyway, I'm not sure where else to go with this, but it's something that I love looking at this kind of work. It moves me and I'm just sort of stuck in this puzzle of like, why am I not trying this? And if I feel like I'm trying it, it might be just trying to like copy somebody else or do something. Like, I don't know how to sort of tap into it for myself to make it mine and not make it a mistake or a one-off. Like, you know, this idea, if you do one shot that's out of focus, it's a mistake. If you do a handful of shots, it's a trend. If you do 1,000 shots, it's a style, someone said, right? You know, so, you know, would this be something I would want to experiment with? Because if I like it so much in other work, and the one time or two times that I do it, I'm like, oh, that's nice. That's interesting. Why wouldn't I do more of it? You know, it's just this muscle memory of going back to, you know, making sure everything's in focus. And I think that's part of it. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, for me, I'm in sort of entrenched in my style and I don't get out as much as I used to. So I will tend to revert right back to my street, whatever ethos with the camera on my chest, right? We make it a project. I mean, that's what we got to do. So,
well, yeah, you mean to try that out, how to do it intentionally. I mean, I really like that shot that you have of the little kid, and like to take that and translate it to like, you know, how could I do that or do something like that intentionally, and not just do it like randomly, like to know with intention that, you know, because you can't just do it with every subject. I don't think it's a thing for every subject. So how do you find this? You know, this is not a question I think we can answer now, but like, how do you find the subject? How do you know when it's an appropriate style to use that you're going to tap into something emotional? Because that's what we're talking about. This kind of pictures move into something that's a little bit more, you know, towards the inner body instead of the eyes and the head. It's the heart and soul a little bit. I mean, to be kind of, you know, whatever about it, you know, woo-woo, if we're going to say that. I don't want to say woo-woo because I don't want to put that down. That's actually an important part of it. But the idea of a dreamlike quality or, you know, foggy memories and stuff like that, which I think are really part of our existence, and we need to acknowledge it. And to do that with photography would be a great thing to do. So how do we do that? So I don't know if you've got an answer or have a thought that you can throw in
just,
there.
It's like everything else, like the Nike ad, just do it, right?
Well, yeah. What would be like a first step? Like, you know,
look at some of these images from others.
Huh?
I mean, we get inspiration from others.
Yeah.
So if you have to ape somebody else, if I'm pretending to be William Klein for a while, then I'll do that, you know, just to get it out of your system. And
let's say, what kind of position would you put yourself in to try to do that? Like, what, you know, would a landscape photographer be able to do this? Like, would that work? Would animal photography? I mean, it does sound like you could do it with a lot of different genres of photography.
Sure. I mean, landscape, I could see being close to a tree that's out of focus, that, you know, with sky in the background. Like, I just am imagining, mm-hmm. you know, different scenarios of a main subject that would traditionally be in focus, not be in focus.
A sports shot. That would be like, sports would be really
sports and a slow shutter speed with sports. I mean,
slow shutter speed with sports too. Yeah. But I'm wondering,
I've got some speed skating pictures where it's a slower shutter speed and they're something.
Yeah. You know, again, we're talking about two different things. I'm thinking about your book, that you did with Mark Ryerson. You have the rider with the flag. Remember, who shot that one?
Rider with the
flag. Yeah, you have a horse rider with an American flag going, and it was a pan shot with a slow shutter speed in your book.
Is it in the book or was it?
It's in the book. In the book, because I just showed it to my class. I don't have the book. Oh, yeah. I got the book next to me. Hang on. Well, you have a lot of things where you're doing pan stuff, but you have
there's pans and the barrel racers are good subjects.
Of course, I'm going to spend all this time while we're talking looking for the shot.
Well, we can cut
this
out.
This is your book. You should know this.
I should know this, but I'm just trying to imagine. It's not coming to me.
It's not?
No.
Oh, well, I mean, there's this picture of the horse, the woman on the horse riding.
Marks. Yeah.
So maybe it's maybe
all
this
the good
is a mark.
Pictures in the book are
maybe
marks.
This is a mark picture. Hang on, where is it? Oh man, I used it in my presentation this past weekend, which I didn't talk about, by the way. Which is maybe I'll leave that for the next episode. I wanted to talk to you about my class this weekend. Yeah. Where's the picture? It was in the PDF, I swear, because I pulled it out. All right,
I know that there was a picture of a show rider with a flag riding away from me that was blurry that I took with the long lens this last year.
Yeah. All right. Well, you know what? Maybe it's possible I'm confusing that with another photograph.
Yeah. Cause it's the same event, just 7 years apart or 8 years.
All right. So never mind.
That one was okay. So let's say it's that picture that it took last spring. That was, The whole idea was I took the Nikon 105 macro lens and I was using it, or no, it was a 105 or 135, 105. And I was using it exclusively that weekend. And so I got some different action pictures of the riders being thrown, and there's a lot more violence actually in this group of pictures from this last year. And when the show riders go out, they're the Calgary Stampede show riders. So they're kind of a semi-professional troop of riders that go out and they're all dressed up and they have flags and they go out one after the other to go into the show ring to announce or whatever, or they're doing an actual show prancing around and so on. So when they were riding away from me, I just pointed the camera as they were riding away from me. And I was getting fragments of, you know, one of the show riders holding the flag or another one, you know, a little bit further down or the horse's head or whatever. And the idea was, is it would probably be out of focus, blurry, something, but I could use them as a few of them as an impressionistic sequence is what I was thinking for that. And one or two of those images work okay as an individual picture, But the intention was to have a little sequence of here they go, you know, the show writers are heading off.
Do you think you could could have done a whole larger sequence of those, or do you think it would get tiresome after a while? I'm guessing in the subjects that you're working in, you'd probably want to break it up because otherwise could you make an impression
for them to write out is only about 10 seconds.
But I mean, like with other pictures too, like, you know, would that be a, you know, if you did an entire project at the Stampede where blur and out of focus was the technique that you brought across the feeling of the whole event, or would this not, would that just not?
Oh, I would, something? I wouldn't do the whole event. I would devote one day,
one
or
day,
2 days or 3 days out of the nine.
I see. All right.
Because I still want to get, my heart is in the, but yeah, I would definitely, maybe that's something we got to put on the agenda.
Maybe it is. I'm just wondering if we could, and whether I could or not, tackle something in this way and try to sort of reverse the idea of trying to be perfect and break down that sort of muscle memory that is so stuck with, you know, doing things perfectly, trying to recreate the world. And why not do it in other ways, include blur and motion and intentional focus things, and intentional, in other words, all this is on purpose, to see if you can tap into that dream feeling memory kind of thing. It might not work, but it always seems to. Oh, you know, speaking of blur, sorry, that was actually, now that I've got my, I'll end on this because I know we're going a little over here, but in my photo journal, there's this picture that I have that was a Pulitzer Prize winning, and I'm not sure it's going to focus on it, but you know this picture?
Yeah. We've talked about it a couple of times.
Yeah.
What's it called?
I can't remember.
It's got a name.
Let me describe it. It's a photograph taken in the 60s, 70s, early 70s. It was a protest in Boston. And the picture is of a black lawyer being sort of held down and he's trying to get away. And this white guy on the right is got an American flag that he's about to, almost looks like he's about to stab him with the, the flag.
Impale him with the flag pole.
Right. And there's intentional, I mean, there's out of focusness in it. You know, the guy in the foreground is not sharp. In fact, I think the focus is more in the background. The photographer caught this in an instant, and I haven't written about it yet. I have a page sort of devoted to it, and it won the Pulitzer Prize. And I remember as a kid looking at this all the time, and I never thought about the picture being something about it being out of focus or not. And especially when you look at a lot of Pulitzer Prize pictures or older photojournalistic shots where focus and blur and stuff like that was never really a big issue if the subject of the picture was strong enough. And this picture has this motion in it. It always looked to me like a photograph of a painting, French Revolution kind of thing, or just something. And then when you read the story about it, actually the story is really interesting. I won't get into that. Maybe we should do a podcast on this episode, on this picture, because I could talk about this thing forever. But it's got the stuff that we're talking about. There's this motion and intensity, of course, the event itself and the symbolism of the guy with the flag about to, you know, the white guy with the flag about to hit, you know, a black guy in a suit who's trying to get away. And it's like, you know, it's an amazing story, but built into the picture are these things that we're talking about. Like it's, and it was never really an issue. It was never like, well, that picture was not sharp, so we're not going to use it or whatever. Like, you know, focus and stuff like that, we gets overrated, and we forget that we can do these kind of things with feelings and like, you know, turn the camera off, and it doesn't have to be perfect. So anyway, I'm not doing that justice to that photograph. I think that it deserves its own, you know, talk for a half an hour. But I think it was a good idea to talk about this because it's something that, you know, if anything, if I'm getting stagnant in the kind of pictures I'm taking and I'm getting bored, you know, experimentation is always interesting. And it takes me a lot of effort to like think about experimenting to sort of break out of the habit of trying to do things.
I think I would be okay. You know, I would just have to remember to give myself an assignment.
Yeah.
I really like the idea of getting an assignment, like a project assignment, as long as it's not something too convoluted, like food photography or product photography,
right,
where
right,
you have
right.
to set up a studio environment, but just say, oh, today we're doing blue, or we're, you know,
yeah,
all doing right. blue, you know, I just well,
put that like on your, put that on your, agenda. Okay. If you can figure something out. I know you're not able to go and photograph in the city as much anymore because of your job. You're in a different location, but
yeah,
you know, we get the chance to, and you know, I'm trying to think of stuff to photograph. And so be great to sort of wander around places that I've been already and decide to approach it in this format, you know, to, you know, William Klein style or a Titarenko style where, you know.
Well, Titarenko, I think you'd need to have 1,000 neutral density.
Right. Yeah. Well, I was thinking like, what if you did that at night and like a place that's very crowded with Times Square, everybody's yeah. moving, you know, yeah. without trying to attract. But anyway, it's like, it's worth trying. It's this kind of stuff that's trying. So I think blur and photography and out of focusness is something to pay more attention to. And, you know, maybe we can circle back to this when we've done some shots and, you know, sure. I'll put some of the pictures that we're talking about, you know, if I could put your kid picture and I'll put my,
yeah.
my angel picture in the show notes so we can see that and links to the other photographers who've copied the style. And I wish I could find this other photographer. If I can, I'll throw him in there. But the one who's photographing with the 4x5 camera past infinity, maybe I have to look for that under that search and entry. Well, anyway, I think, cool. Wow. All right. I was like, I think I need to stop talking now because I could keep going.
I think we're done.
Well, for the moment. Yeah. But I like this subject and I kind of like how we could circle back to Steichen, you know, with the pictorialism and stuff. So mm-hmm. that tickles me. We can do yeah. that. Woo, I'm tickled. So where are we finding you in the world of places, things, and ideas?
Well, you can find me on Twitter and Vero at WRosinPhoto. On Instagram, I'm at Ward Rosin Fine Art. That's WARDROSIN Art. On Facebook, I'm Ward Rosin Photo. I have a little website where I sell my fine prints and the book when it becomes available again. And I think Mark has a couple of copies he's hoarding. And hopefully I'll be able to get them off him and sell them. And that's at rosin.ca, ROSIN.ca. And then our unofficial sponsor.
Unofficial sponsor. Photo.
ORNIS.photo, where you sell can those. Find seven artisans, lenses, and lens adapters.
Sell those lenses. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
what about you, Antonio?
Where am I? I am nowhere to be found. I am so done with Twitter. I don't even post there anymore, so don't look for me there. But Vero and Flickr is at AM Rosario. Instagram at AM Rosario Photo. My website is amrosario.com. Our website, streetshots.photography, and subscribe to our Substack newsletter, which I just put out one last week about photojournaling again. So it's streetshots.substack.com. And if you want to leave us a voicemail like Mike did, speakpipe.com/streetshots. Try saying that five times fast. I can't even say five times fast. Five times fast.
Seashells by the seashore. Yeah.
And if you want to support the show, you can buy me a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/Antonio Rosario. That helps pay for some of the stuff on the show. And we've had some people.
And we did have somebody buy us some coffee.
Yes, we did. We've had some. I think I mentioned it last time. And It was good. Also, I just want to mention, if you want to check out our Unusual Collective, it's unusualcollective.photography. It's kind of a good, very good URL. So check us out. We're doing. We haven't put any essays up on there lately, but the stuff that we've got up there is some really nicely written essays about photography.
Yeah, and some of my Mexico work there.
Yeah, yeah. And so go check that out. But yeah, that's it. We got it covered. We got the night covered. So, Ward, thank cool. you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, sorry better about last night.
Never.
Yeah, it's all right. It's like I'm never going to live that down, but that's fine. I deserve what I get. So, yes, I'm a bad boy. Sounding like Abbott and Costello. But anyway, sorry. Isn't Costello said that? No, only the cartoon said that.
The cartoons. The
cartoon yeah. said that. Never said that. I don't know if he said that. Anyway, I'm going off the subject. So, anyway, thank you so much for joining us tonight. And
my pleasure.
I will see you in the outer reaches. And for everybody else, see you guys in April. So have a good night.
Good night.